I have a nuclear take. If I am Kyle Dubas, okay, and it's day one of Maple Leafs training camp, and I'm addressing the media, I say this. If we don't have Mitch Marner under contract, doesn't have to be playing on opening night, but if we don't have him under contract by the time puck drops on opening night of the regular season, we are shutting down negotiations. We are not going through the William Nylander situation again. I believe the player has the leverage here, even though he has no arbitration eligibility and is a restricted free agent. Kyle Dubas, take the leverage back. Am I nuts?
I mean, you're not nuts that it's a possibility he could say it, as long as we all agree it's a giant lie, because his team is exponentially better with Mitch Marner on the ice, and Kyle Dubas has a mandate to try to win a cup within the next couple of years. From that aspect, I think, Lord knows there's a little bit of kabuki acting that goes on in these negotiations where now Darren Ferris, for the third straight client, is threatening to take his talents to Zurich. There's a certain amount of that sort of, play acting that goes on in these negotiations anyway. But everybody knows that if, Mitch Marner's camp reaches out to Kyle Dubas in November and the Leafs are, a point out of the wild card, it's not as if Kyle's going to just put his phone on mute.
Quite right. Quite right. But this is the first time you mentioned, third straight year that Darren Ferris is pulling some European threats. This time, the European team, with the blue check mark beside its name, so I knew it was real, the Zurich Lions, actually tweeted about this.
Yeah, but I wrote about this in my column today. There's a grand tradition of restricted free agents trying to use European teams as leverage. It goes all the way back to when Ryan Johansson was a restricted free agent with the Columbus Blue Jackets, and his agent started talking about the mysterious KHL offer coming his way. So it's always happened this way, that the teams also get involved because the camps reach out to them, and then those teams talk to local media. In this case, it was the Zurich Lions kind of taking it to the streets themselves. But there needs to be that sort of other side of the equation that's an active participant in this charade, which is basically what I think it is. Like you said, when you're a restricted free agent, you don't have a whole heck of a lot of leverage, the offer sheet being the biggest one. But as we learned this year, there's a reason why they're so rare. So this European gambit is something that usually we get to at this part of the negotiation. And then, like you said, then it'll be the ball back in Dubas' court to see if he decides to pull out some sort of nuclear option of his own.
So you wrote about the Zurich situation. You wrote about how the NHL has changed over the last decade. You wrote about the best of the decade. I'm wondering, when are you going to start writing, man?
I did take a week away from writing last week. And I did the real thing. I did I didn't put my fingers on the keyboard to write a story or anything. And I read books. I read a book of I read a book about the history of 1980s children's cartoons.
Very on
and
brand.
How they were all based on toy lines. It's called The Rise and Fall of the 80s Toon Empire. And going back and realizing that every single thing that I enjoyed as a child was invented just so my mom would buy me a toy is a little humbling. I felt like I might owe her money after reading the book, quite frankly.
So you wrote about the best of, the worst of the decade. I want to know how hard it was to come up with the list. Because for me, it's just too easy to just sort of lean on recency bias and everything. But you have the best team of the past decade being the 2009-2010 Chicago Blackhawks. How'd you get there?
Oh, I just think, a combination of on-ice accomplishment, what they ended up doing in the playoffs, and then just kind of the eye test. You take a look at that team, and the amount, it's staggering how much talent that they had on that roster. that eventually they had to get rid of because of the salary cap. It was, you know, Kane, Taves, Keith, Sharp, Versteeg, Brouwer, Ladd, Byfuglien, Seabrook, when he was, you know, before the contract, Yarmolson, Boland in his prime, Campbell was on the roster, Hossa was on the roster, and, you know, the only weak link on the team was Niemi, and, you know, that was a situation where I think, you know, the team was so incredibly deep and good that they won despite him. So it was fun to look back at the last decade, not only for that piece, but the crafting a team of the best or most representative players for all 31 teams was fun too, because it led to some really uncomfortable situations, because I was going to stick to the positions as, you know, no cheating. So, like, Malkin's left off the Pittsburgh team because he's a center and Sid's a center. I mean, granted, he's used to being left off of giant lists by now, thanks NHL. But yeah. It did lead to, like, some, you know, the Detroit Red Wings. I mean, I'm not going to cheat and have Zetterberg and Datsyuk on the same line. It's either Zetterberg or Datsyuk, and I think Zetterberg is more representative of the Red Wings in the last decade than Datsyuk was, but then that led Datsyuk Nation to grab their torches and come after me on Twitter. So it was a real interesting exercise, and, you know, with the caveat that the decade's not done yet, so things can still shift, but it was interesting to look back and really get a snapshot of which players represented these teams and which teams, you know, deserve to be remembered for the last 10 years.
With Greg Wyshynski, who is the senior hockey writer for ESPN at Sportsnet today. Sportsnet 590, The Fan.
Yeah, and Greg kind of started with that fun edict by Scott about Kyle Dubas saying that regarding Mitch Marner's situation. I mean, guys like Hampus Lindholm and Risto Ristolainen, and there's been other guys that have bled into the regular season to some degree, but I am curious, because the RFAs are the stories, and they've never been to this degree, this kind of volume. Donnie Meehan spoke up and said, wait a sec, we're doing our own thing with Matthew Tkachuk. We presented an offer in June. Now we hear there's a Brock Besser type of deal that's going on. I mean, which of all these RFAs, which seem to be lumped in together, do you see headway being made, does Mitch Marner stand alone as seeming brinkmanship, or is that a little bit more common with these guys?
Well, we've never had the glut of great young RFAs kind of all hitting the market at the same time. So the more you think about this stalemate, the more you think about, like, the end of Reservoir Dogs, where they all have the guns pointed at each other. Like, everybody's waiting for the other guy to sign. I've talked to NHL team executives in the last couple of weeks who told me a couple things. They told me, first of all, that, and this is, you know, obviously to benefit themselves, they're going to try to frame the Marner contract when it does happen as like the Draisaitl deal. Like, they all consider the Draisaitl deal with Edmonton to be an outlier. That, you know, it was a deal that he struck with them. It's a very personal deal between the player and the team. It shouldn't necessarily affect market value, and that's kind of how they're trying to frame the Marner deal, because they know he's not going through the typical comparables, situation. He's you know, going on his own numbers and going on what Matthews makes. The contract they're all looking at, as far as maybe setting the market, is whatever Braden Point gets from the Tampa Bay Lightning, which I thought was interesting. I had a couple people tell me that. And then on the defensive side, it's everybody waiting to see what Charlie McAvoy gets with Boston. I mean, that's, you know, whatever McAvoy gets will affect whatever Provorov gets. It'll affect whatever Werenski gets with Columbus. That's the contract that everybody's kind of waiting on there. So there are certain sort of, you know, linchpins here where if one guy signs, I think you're just going to see the dominoes fall pretty quickly, but they're all waiting for that one guy to sign, and it's been an interesting process to see it play out.
Just letting you know, this will be the last time you're on the show for mentioning Braden Point being ahead of Mitch Marner. You're about to get, like, abducted by the underbelly of the hockey world and and stuffed into a van. You're not even allowed to mention Braden Point. What's if you're Kyle Dubas? Yes, we're making you do this again. Do you not on purpose make this go as long as possible? Because if the entire NHL, if this group of, like, a couple dozen, star RFAs is all waiting on this guy, isn't the move for you to wait too?
I mean, sure. I mean, insofar as, like, trying to make it as uncomfortable as possible.
Yeah, because screw them. Like, screw everyone else in the NHL. It's their problem. If they're waiting on your guy and you wait, good. Screw it. It's funny.
Sure. Why not? Yeah. I mean, he might not endear himself to to his peers all that much by doing so. But I think at the end of the day, a lot of these teams are probably just going to have to say, look, it's more important for us to get you into camp than it is to, you know, have you waiting around to see what kind of offers, your peer group are getting. So the training camp thing really is a significant part of this equation where it can be used as a pressure point. These guys don't necessarily want to be the ones that are out of camp when it starts and out of sync with their teams and having to adjust and yada, yada, yada. So I think there's a certain pressure point there that these GMs can possibly use that might be able to get these guys in without there being that comparable contract that comes through. But it remains to be seen. I mean, the gears are really gummed up right now. And I mean, the only really guy that's signed is the guy that got offer sheeted, right? So it's been interesting to watch.
With Greg Wyshynski of ESPN, I'm actually going to come back to this Braden Point thing, even though you've been stuffed in a van or something, according to Dangle, that is. He's the best player out of this entire RFA group that we focus in on, right? I mean, is there even a debate about that?
I mean, there's a certain bias towards the fact that he is a borderline elite center. I mean, that I think the position thing is something you can't really divorce in the equation, and the fact that this guy can be a potential junior Patrice Bergeron type for that team is something that you can't ignore. I mean, you also can't ignore the point totals that Mitch Marner has put up in the last couple of years for Toronto. So, I mean, I'm always going to kind of be positionally biased towards that type of player because it's so rare to find someone with point skill set to be able to be that kind of offensive force while also being a silky quality defensive player. So from that aspect, maybe there's a little bit of a who would you build your team around kind of thing too. You could make the argument that he's the most valuable guy in the market, but Marner's a special player.
Yeah, that, no, there's no doubt.
And to have that guy kind of offense coming off your wing is just stunning. And not only that, but I mean, there's also a sort of, if you were going to look, again, from a team building perspective, there's a certain marketability that Marner brings to the table that maybe Point doesn't. Marner being, the boisterous guy who wants to be in commercials, and Braden Point basically being like an honorary Sutter. He just wants to be on a farm. He just wants to keep himself.
Well, Greg, because, I mean, the reason I bring it up, it just feels like comparables have been obliterated here, and it's almost like there's this comparison to your internal environment. So is Kucherov the guy to which Point will not necessarily himself look, but the guy to which the team will look? Okay, he's making 9.5. And meanwhile, a guy like Mitch is looking at Austin making an 11.5 and Tavares making 11 and saying, okay, I got to get into the double digits here. I got to get into the eight figures. So maybe it doesn't matter who's the best out of this group. It's what are the internal parameters as it pertains to each team, and then factor in the fact that Toronto is the craziest and most obsessed market, and so Marner's going to get the most chatter. I'm just trying to figure out who they all think they're waiting for most.
Well, yeah, and then you also have to kind of factor in the personal psychology of the whole thing, too. I mean, like, when Stamkos re-signed with the Lightning, famously, he took some level of discount because he wanted them to have a little bit of flexibility to go ahead and sign other guys. I mean, Kucherov's contract, obviously, is cap-friendly from that perspective, too, and the tax situation of Florida sort of, helps that out as well. I think when you look at Point, you look at Marner, you say to yourself, okay, what is the main driving catalyst for their desire to get this contract? And in Point's case, it may simply just be, I'm going to get the highest yield I can on a short-term deal to give my team, added flexibility as we go forward because they have so much money in their cap already. In Marner's case, it could simply be, I could care less about the cap situation about this team because, they took care of everybody else before they took care of me. I mean, there's a certain amount of what the player wants out of this equation, too. And, you could say this about the Lightning, and I don't know if it's, if it was Steve Yzerman's sort of Jedi mind tricks or just the way that the philosophy of the team is. You got a lot of guys on that team that have taken cap-friendly deals. And the economics of the state have something to do with that, but also I think the reality of knowing that in order to keep this team together, we have to take a little bit off the top has definitely been a prevailing wisdom there, and I think that tracks back to Stamkos.
Greg, Steve Dangle was kidding earlier saying, when's Greg Wyshynski going to start writing? You got so many great stories out right now. One really interesting one is you said how the NHL's changed in the past 10 years and what's next. And, you know, you talk about analytics, fighting, disappearing, a number of things that happened. You look back at it. What changes have you liked and what do you kind of said? Oh, I kind of liked it the way it was.
You know, the playoff format's always going to be a sticking point for me because I think that they tried to fix something that wasn't broken. We're in sort of that middle period where the previous format was better. The current format has its champions and has its advantages. It definitely doesn't have a lot of fans in the sense that, you know, two of the best teams in the playoffs always have to meet in the first round based on this bracketing. I mean, that's just stupid. I wish they didn't have that. And then, you know, we're in the future, I think we're probably going to get an expansion of the playoffs and some play-in games and things like that. So we'll you know, hold the jury out until we get there. So not a huge fan of the change in the playoffs format. But as far as almost everything else, I mean, it's been a remarkably good decade for the league. You know, I went back and read Gary Bettman's State of the NHL press conference from 2010. And, you know, he's talking about the league's revenues growing very slowly because we're coming out of the recession and calming people's fears about teams leaving their markets and all this other stuff. And a lot of that stuff's kind of gone by the wayside as we enter, you know, as we close in on 2020. And it's been pretty remarkable to see, especially when it comes to things like the stability of, like, the Arizona Coyotes, for example. You know, for the first time ever, they're like a cap team. It's kind of crazy to see how that played out.
With Greg Wyshynski of ESPN, not saying the cap is going to be modified or changed significantly in any way in the next CBA negotiations, Greg, but more of a personal opinion question. Do you like the cap as it is? And if not, what would you change about it? And I'm framing this from my perspective, which is, some of these young teams that draft and develop well, and we're seeing what players want on their second contracts now, the star players who are RFAs and pre-arbitration eligible. Like, some teams are getting jammed up before they really accomplish anything on the ice. Leafs haven't been to the second round in 15 years, and they're already kind of jammed up. Do you like the cap, and what would you change about it if you could?
I mean, I think the cap has some virtue in the sense that it has created some economic stability. In the words of my good friend, the commissioner, cost certainty. And it certainly helped on that aspect too. But I, for the last, you know, 15 years, have been pretty candid about being a luxury tax guy. I don't necessarily like the cap system. I don't necessarily like the idea that or support the idea that the NHL is better for having teams that constantly have to churn their roster over and over again because the only thing they're guilty of is being good and having to pay their players after being good. I think having, you know, stronger, like if you kept that Blackhawks team together for a few more years, I mean, that's a dynastic team that they had back in like 2010, 2011, that kind of area. So I've always been a luxury tax guy. I think that there's a system that you can work out where the teams like the Leafs and the higher revenue teams can, you know, go over the cap and have severe tax penalties, and that money can help out the lower lights of the league. And I also think that they just need to be a bit more creative. You know, maybe it's time we get more towards the NFL model where you put a franchise tag on guys. Certain players that are making exponentially more than their teammates can have a tag on them where their money doesn't count against the cap, and then add some flexibility that way. There are ways to make this system more advantageous for the successful teams and for, you know, trying to create bigger and better, more elite franchises versus this giant pile of mashed potatoes of parity that we have. I just think that it's going to take the owners wanting to be a bit more courageous about the way they go about structuring the financial system because the players don't have any leverage to do so.
Pivoting from talking about teams that are just far too good for their own good, I want to get back to your best teams of the past decade thing, and you did your all Leafs team. Wow. So Austin Matthews is your center. I don't think anyone would debate that. James Van Riemsdyk, he had some unbelievable goal-scoring seasons, totally. Phil Kessel makes a lot of sense. you know, even though Mitch Marner's a right winger, Phil Kessel was there longer, was pretty much money in the bank. Morgan Riley makes a ton of sense. How did you get to your other defender being Dion Phaneuf?
Representative of the decade. I mean, it's not simply just, you know, who are the best, you know, six players for each team, or else how does Justin Abdelkader ever make it on the Detroit team?
Oh, my God.
It's also kind of drawing what was representative for the decade. Now, you could obviously argue other defensemen in place of Phaneuf. I felt that Phaneuf's, you know, place in the overall story of the decade, the Leafs kind of mandated that he'd be on this team. But you could definitely, you know, make the argument that that's the iffiest pick of the five skaters. I think the other four are kind of unimpeachable. I don't think you could tell the story of the Leafs in the last decade properly without having Kessel over Marner on that team, for example.
You blindsided me a little bit with Abdelkader. Who was the player you were most shocked made their all-decade team on any team in the league?
That's a good question. There was a couple, like the idea that Mike Hoffman made the Ottawa team, for example, that's just sort of out of nowhere. The fact that Johan Franzen, the Detroit team, by the way, just to tell you, was Zetterberg, Abdelkader, Franzen, Lidstrom, Cronwall, Howard. Like, the defense, obviously, right? No problems there. But, like, you look back at the lineage of left wings on that team. I'm not going to make Zetterberg a left wing just because it's going to allow me to put Datsyuk on the team. I mean, they were both centers through the majority of the decade. So there wasn't really another option at left wing other than Justin Abdelkader. And then at right wing, you know, it's kind of amazing to think about Franzen being as salient as he was in the last decade when you think about how long he's been out of the game, pretty much. There are a few here and there. The one that obviously has gotten a lot of attention from Devils fans is Kovalchuk over Paul, and you know, to a lesser extent, Parise on left wing. I just think that, you know, when you're talking about the story of the decade for the Devils thus far, just without question, Hall's story has been remarkable. I mean, he wins the Hart Trophy, gets them into the playoffs. But, you know, Kovalchuk got them through three rounds of the playoffs, their only Stanley Cup appearance in the decade. And it's hard for me to kind of look at the past decade of the Devils and say that Kovalchuk shouldn't be the guy that's sort of representative of that position. But, I mean, there's a lot of people that are wondering where the hell Taylor Hall is on this list.
With Greg Wyshynski, senior hockey writer for ESPN on Sportsnet today.
Greg, it's summer 2019. It's almost fall 2019, which means it's almost winter 2020. What is that 10 years away from? Do you remember?
Winter 2020? No, what would that be?
That would be the golden goal in Vancouver at the 2010 Olympic Games. And I just remember seeing you tweet about this a few months ago, and you're dreading all the retrospectives.
Oh, yeah.
Obviously, as my American hockey friend, are you looking forward to writing your own?
I am. First of all, just a quick correction. Please refer to it by its proper name, the Aginla Assist.
Ah, yes.
As we all know it. look, it was an amazing tournament, and just we'll never have it again, probably, like it was, you know, to have those two teams be that good at the same time and have the tournament in Canada. And it was just great. It was just some of the best hockey ever and some of the best drama ever. And you know, I came to terms with it. I covered that was the first Olympics I covered, and I came to terms with it pretty quickly. That, you know, as I was walking back from the arena, being really pissed off that we lost, and being it's the Olympics, we can say we. It's a journalistic mandate that you can say we. when I was walking through Vancouver and you know, seeing all these celebrations, this is, you know, a good, what, 2 years before they tried to burn their city down.
One year.
Oh, that's right. 1 year. Right. So it occurred to me that, like, this meant so much more to these people than it meant to me. Like, it would have been wonderful for Americans to get one over on the Canadians. And I still remember talking to Patrick Kane up there about him growing up as an American player and dealing with this. He said, you know, it was a situation where when you went and had Canadian teammates or went and played against Canadian teams, their default setting was you're not as good as we are because you're American. And like, he grew up with that. And you hear that from someone like Kane, you're just like, oh man, we got to take these guys down. Right. So there's a certain amount of that going on. But at the end of the day, like, when you take a step back, it meant exponentially more to the people in that city and the people in the country than it did to Americans to win that medal on Canadian ice in that situation and have Crosby score it and all that other stuff. So I made my peace with it, you know, pretty quickly. But in the moment, man, it was like being a Mets fan in the Subway Series against the Yankees and thinking, my God, if we could just get this one.
I just wonder. You
know, we'll have some scintilla of bragging rights if we could just get this one.
Greg, because I've never heard it, so I'm not saying it hasn't been asked. I wonder if you asked Patrick Kane, would you trade your game-winning goal months later in the Stanley Cup Final against the Flyers for that gold medal? Like, to be the hero in that game in February as opposed to that game in June. I wonder what he'd say.
It's a tough call because, like, I mean, you can't divorce the fact that he's got two other rings, right?
Right.
So, like, I'm sure he'd trade it in a millisecond to have one Olympic gold. I have found through the years, though, the interesting dichotomy between North American players and their feelings about winning a Stanley Cup and European players and their feelings about winning a gold medal. The Europeans care exponentially more about international play than do the North Americans, I've come to find. Not saying it's all that like that. I mean, there's definitely Canadian kids who want to grow up and win a gold for their country and American kids who want to do the same. But, you know, I've talked to European players that, you know, don't care about winning a cup as much as winning a gold for their country, which is kind of crazy to think.
But well, and that's what makes me feel better about Sundin, is that he got his gold medal as a captain at the 2006 Olympics, even though he never won a cup, because I love Matt Sundin and always will. Thanks, pal.
Yeah, Lundqvist the same way, by the way. Like, at least Lundqvist had that moment in his career. He may never win a cup,
right?
You know, with the Rangers, but at least he had that moment in the same Olympics to get that gold.